a new justice on our bench today, and because of that, I will introduce all of the justices on the bench to those of you who are present, but I will begin with our newest colleague, Daniel Kelly. Next to Justice Kelly is Justice Gableman. Next to Justice Gableman, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Next to me is Justice Shirley Abrahamson. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the very far end, Justice Rebecca Bradley. So, with those introductions, I will call the first case, State versus Weber. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Good morning. I'd like to start by saying this case is not about a bad brake light. The only relevance that brake light has is that it gave the deputy in this case lawful authority to command to stop. When Mr. Weber didn't stop, everything else unfolded. Lights went on. Mr. Weber continued to drive, ignoring the lights, turned into and drove down his driveway, pulled into his garage, the deputy behind him, lights on the entire time. He parked in his garage. The deputy lost sight of him, exited his squad, got out so he could see him again. Mr. Weber was headed up into the whole attached garage, apparently, headed up the stairs or made his way toward those stairs to go into his house. The deputy shouts to him, stop, I need to talk to you. I need to talk to you about your taillight. Mr. Weber ignores him. The deputy at that point moves into the garage and telling him again, I need to speak with you, Mr. Weber. Mr. Weber again ignores him, continues and tries to get into the house. At that point, the deputy takes hold of him, pulls him back outside to have the discussion they were meant to have, back out on the highway, where Weber refused to stop for the deputy. And at that point, then, obviously, there came additional evidence about the drunk driving, which I don't think is really pertinent to why we're here today. If this case were just about a bad brake light, I wouldn't be standing here. It's about everything else that happened after that. And it was Weber's flight from a valid traffic stop that warranted the entry into
Counsel?
The home. Yes.
What's curtilage in this case?
I can see, Your Honor, that the garage is part of the home for this.
What about the driveway?
Yeah, if you want to call it curtilage, that's fine. I think it's appropriate, though, at this point. When Weber fails to stop on the public highway where he should have stopped.
Okay. And it does, curtilage means the same as house. Is there a difference between the actual physical house and the curtilage in terms of the law?
In this case, I don't see that that's a distinction that is
okay.
Particularly relevant in it.
How long in terms of time between the lights going on and him getting to the driveway?
I don't think the record is specific on that point.
How many yards or feet are we talking about on the street?
The deputy estimated that 100 feet passed from the time he put the lights on and the time Mr. Weber turned into his driveway.
And then there were estimates, at least in the briefs. I haven't read the record, but at least in the briefs, that might have been anywhere from, 3 to 5, 6 seconds to get from the street
to the driveway. Speculation. I couldn't tell you standing here.
Okay.
I don't think counsel can really either,
okay,
how long exactly that takes. But I don't think it matters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ultimately, you look at the totality of the circumstances and you decide whether the deputy had reason to believe that Mr. Weber was fleeing a traffic stop, and it's the state's position he did.
Counsel, is it your position that it is only fleeing the traffic stop that warranted the seizure?
I think that's primary from my perspective, but ultimately, I think clearly there's a basis here for obstructing as well, and I lay that out in my brief. So I think there are two jailable offenses that Mr. Weber committed when he failed to stop properly for the deputy's show of authority or the bad brake light. So I think there are two bases, at least.
And the obstruction occurred when the officer was outside the garage and Mr. Weber was inside the garage?
You know, it is difficult always, I think, to pinpoint the precise moment when probable cause arises. It's a fluid concept. It balances on a dime, and you drop a hair of evidence, and that dime could tip one way or the other.
Well, didn't the obstruction begin when the officer commanded him to stop?
It began, absolutely, and it continued.
Okay. And when he commanded him to stop, he was in the garage.
Well, my position is that he commanded him to stop when he hit the lights out on the public highway.
Right. So we have, and correct me if I'm wrong, we have three pursuits. One, the pursuit for the broken taillight. Two, the pursuit when he failed to pull over when he was supposed to. And then three, when he obstructed the officer when he was told to stop when he was inside his garage and not go into the house. Is that correct?
I would call it one continuous pursuit. It began when the officer hit the lights, and it ended when he finally was able to put hands on Mr. Weber and bring him outside and have a conversation they should have had back out on the road. And this stop evolved and changed the moment Mr. Weber failed to stop out on the public highway, as just about everybody else would do and should do.
But as the stop evolves, that potentially gives you a greater authority to seize without a warrant.
Absolutely.
Okay. So as we look at the way the stop evolved, at what point did it become appropriate for the officer to seize him without a warrant?
I think certainly at the point the deputy is standing outside of the garage, not only having had his lights on and ignored all the way down the road and down the driveway, and then shouting to Mr. Weber and saying, I need to speak with you, Mr. Weber, and being ignored. At that point, he gets to go into the garage. He gives him again another verbal instruction. I need to speak with you. That is ignored. He gets to take hold of him and bring him outside for that conversation.
Does it make any difference that he said he needed to speak with him about the taillight? Not, I want to speak with you about why you were fleeing from me?
No, I don't think so. What matters is whether that officer has a reasonable basis to believe that Mr. Weber has fled the traffic stop and is obstructing the traffic stop and trying to avoid it. And at that point, I think he certainly did.
And it's intentional. Believe that there's an intentional violation.
Yes. But again, it's probable cause. Does the officer have a reasonable basis to believe there's probable cause that Mr. Weber is intentionally ignoring him,
yeah,
intentionally trying to flee the stop? Might this be an issue at trial? Certainly. But we're talking about probable cause here.
Mm-hmm. The facts are a little unclear to me as I hear the questions and answers this morning. I thought, in looking at the transcript, that the first time the officer spoke to the defendant was as he was just entering the garage.
Justice Bradley, I will tell you, I too wished for a clearer record. I find that that's a wish I often have. But the officer was asked.
I'm referring to page, the officer was asked a number of questions, and then on page 109 of the petitioner's appendix, and the question is, sure, so you're about to enter the garage yourself when you first say that to him, or maybe were you in the garage before you even spoke to him? And he says, no, I think I was just entering the garage.
And line 17, were you in the garage before you even spoke to him? No, I think I was just entering. I was like right at the door. And it continues.
And that's my problem with the facts in this case, mm-hmm, in part. Because what does it mean to be just entering? Was he in?
Well, I think my reasonable interpretation of the testimony, and could it be clear or short, is that he was not. And the court in making its findings, and again, are they terribly specific on that point? No.
In State versus Larson, the court held that an officer's placement of his foot across the threshold of the door to the defendant's apartment was an entry for Fourth Amendment purposes. And because of that, and because of the testimony, I was just entering. I don't know for sure if just entering means across the threshold.
I just don't know what it means, and so I just don't think we can rely on, for our analysis here, anything about the verbal, stop, the verbal admonitions to stop, because if he was already in the curtilage, then the lawfulness, if it was lawful, does not rest on what was done subsequently. I mean, it seems to me, if he was not there lawfully, then you can't consider anything that was done subsequently, and the facts don't allow us to make that determination. Can you respond to that concern, please?
And I understand that question, and I agree with you. For instance, if we all agreed that the facts were undisputed and this deputy saw merely a bad brake light, waited for Mr. Weber to go into his garage, and then, or all the way into the home, and then made warrantless entry kicking down the door just for the bad brake light, we lose. I understand that.
Why do you lose?
Oh, because just the brake light.
No, because it's not jailable.
I think that certainly that's part of the reason. Absolutely, yes. An equipment violation alone doesn't get you into the house without a warrant.
You would have to eliminate not only the speaking of the officer, but the lights that the officer had on, which he left on after the squad car pulled into the driveway in pursuit of Mr. Weber. So two things you'd have to leave out before you would get just to the brake light, correct?
That's right. And my reading of the deputy's testimony is that, this is happening quickly. An arrest like this, it doesn't play out slow motion like in a movie. It happens very, very, very quickly. And as much as we try to break it down into pieces and detailed testimony, I think the deputy is moving, getting sight of Mr. Weber, then when he does, says he needs to speak with him, and he's still moving forward because Weber's moving forward. And ultimately, yes, he breaks that threshold. Is it as he makes his first direction to Mr. Weber to stop? It's approximately there. I mean, do we have a specific measurement? No. I can't tell you exactly where he's standing. He's very close. Outside that garage.
You have the burden on these questions.
We do, but I would say, the record does not establish that the deputy entered that garage before he spoke with Mr. Weber. It does not.
No, nor does it establish the contrary.
I think a reasonable inference is that it does.
And when
it's not specific, but I think
it's a reasonable inference. What were the findings that the trial court made? Don't we have to review those on clearly erroneous standard?
Yes, you do. And again, the trial court is not specific, but the trial court, I think in its findings, although it didn't address precisely when the officer broke that plane, the finding is pretty clear that the officer was warranted in going in, not just because of the show of the lights, but also his verbal instructions that Weber ignored.
Yeah, that authorized in going in is a legal conclusion. We're talking about findings of fact, and there was no finding of fact with regard to the issue that we're talking about, it seems to me, unless you can point that out. And if you can't, maybe on rebuttal, you'll have time to do that.
Yeah, no, what the court says, and I underlined it, anticipating having a conversation about this. Once inside the garage, this is at page 4 of my brief, in the middle of the first paragraph. Mm-hmm. Once inside the garage, the defendant did not wait for the deputy to approach. He instead attempted to flee the deputy, even after obtaining verbal commands. Now, does he say that the deputy was outside? No, but I think a reasonable inference from that is that the deputy was outside asking him to stop.
Counselor,
could
I stop you there? Does it matter whether the deputy was outside or not? Once Mr. Weber is inside his garage, regardless of where the officer is at, if the officer tells him to stop, does he have an obligation to stop since he's already inside his curtilage?
I think Mr. Weber's obligation to stop began out on a public highway, and it continued into the garage.
Okay, so for that analysis to work, then, the obligation and the right for the officer to enter the curtilage and seize him had to have been perfected before Weber entered the garage. Is that correct?
I think that's fair to say, but you're going to ask me to put an X on the ground where that ought to have occurred, I'm not certain I can say that. But it started out on the public highway, certainly.
So for the officer to obtain the authority to arrest him without, or detain him even, without a warrant, he had to have that basis before Mr. Weber drove into the garage.
And again, this is the evolution of probable cause, isn't it? I think the officer certainly had a basis to pursue Mr. Weber, and then getting to the garage and instructing him to come back out, having Mr. Weber ignore him. Things notch up.
Could I change the facts just a wee bit?
Sure.
So let's say Mr. Weber drives into the garage and just sits in his car. Does the officer at that point have the authority to go in and remove him from his car?
You know, I could give you a number of different scenarios. The officer could sit outside and shout at him and be ignored. Mr. Weber could fall over in his seat and need assistance. So many things could happen. This is the kind of a debate. We could come up with hypotheticals falling on one side or the other. Some of us will agree on all of them at the extremes. Then we get to the middle, and I acknowledge we sit here close to the middle
right. On
the facts.
So what I'm trying to get to, though, is by virtue of the fact of Mr. Weber being in his garage, does something additional have to occur for the officer to obtain the authority to seize him without a warrant?
Well, I think in this case something additional did occur.
And
Mr. Weber got out of his car and instructed to come out and speak with the officer, ignored him.
Okay, so now at that point, then your position is that Mr. Weber was not entitled to take advantage of being in his own home. At that point, he had an obligation to respond to the officer, notwithstanding the fact that he was in his own home.
He had an obligation to respond and stop on the public highway. It continued into the garage. It escalated in the garage when he ignored the deputy. And at that point, the deputy was able to make warrantless entry to bring him back out for the stop that should have happened on the highway. That aside, you know, people often say bad facts make bad law. I don't want bad facts to keep the court from making good law, because the state's position here is that hot pursuit. You know, if you take for argument's sake a situation, let's say Mr. Weber led the police on a 5-mile high-speed chase with lights and sirens blazing all the way to his home, and we all agree that that's probable cause for a jailable offense. The officer gets to go in again. That is the law and should be the law.
Without the fleeing, without the action out on the public highway, you don't have an argument, right?
Yes. That's right. And I acknowledge that. But again, I want to talk about the law. We've talked about the facts, and I realize they're debatable.
Let's talk about the law then.
Okay.
And you mentioned hot pursuit. And Smith, at page 229, it sets forth a test when an officer has an urgent need in the hot pursuit, and it's an objective one. It is whether a police officer, under the circumstances, known to the officer at the time of entry, as we just discussed, the time of entry, the facts are a little unclear, reasonably believes that delay in procuring a warrant would gravely endanger life or risk destruction of evidence or greatly enhance the likelihood of the suspect's escape. So that's a 3-part test. That allows you to make entry if the officer reasonably believes that delay in procuring a warrant. So is there any evidence that indicates that it would either, number one, gravely endanger the life, number two, risk destruction of evidence, or three, greatly enhance the likelihood of the suspect's escape?
Before I explain why I think at least a couple of those are present, I want to point out one thing. There are four exigencies that historically have been accepted as a basis for warrantless entry. The first one is hot pursuit. The other three are the three you just read that are sometimes put together in a clause because they're sort of separate exigencies. They're listed as hot pursuit, which is immediate pursuit from the scene of a crime, threat to the safety of the suspect or others, risk of evidence destruction, or likelihood of escape or fleeing.
Doesn't the law, citing Smith and McNeely, both state that that although hot pursuit may, not categorical. Remember, McNeely was found these per se exceptions to be an anathema, and it was hot pursuit may be an exigent circumstance, but you have to establish that it was justified by exigent circumstances. So it isn't a hot pursuit is not a per se exception to the need to get a warrant. It may be under the circumstances.
Well, I think the word may is used as in any circumstance. An exigency may permit an officer to go in. This is a totality of the circumstances analysis to determine whether that exigency exists. Hot pursuit, though, is in fact separate and standalone. It doesn't require hot pursuit plus one of the other three. If it does, why do we even have it as a doctrine?
But it couldn't be hot pursuit of a faulty taillight.
No, it has to be for a jailable offense, absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, I think it harkens back to Welsh, which really was not a hot pursuit case. And that's, we continue to be the only state in the union where first offense drunk driving is a civil forfeiture and not a criminal offense. And with a basis, certainly, to get a warrant, the officer elected instead to go into Mr. Welsh's home and retrieve him in the context of a drunk driving investigation. And at that point, we get the first glimpse that, look, this is just a civil forfeiture. You can't batter down the door based on a civil forfeiture alone. We look at least to a jailable offense.
Ms. Noah, in the remaining minutes you have, I'd like you to take some time to discuss the concept of hot pursuit within the context of Sanders and Richter, how you would like us to apply it based on those cases.
It is, as I've stated, the law is not and should not be that a fleeing suspect can take refuge in his or her home to get away from the police and just lock up and who knows what happens afterwards. I'd like not to talk about that. But I laid it out very specifically at the end of my brief. Hot pursuit of a suspect, and I think it's better stated as immediate pursuit. Hot, I think, brings up visions of, a mass murderer.
Sanders and Richter, Ms. Noah. Sanders and Richter.
Yeah, Sanders, and Sanders is a great example. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the facts in that case. The officers respond to a dog complaint, finding uninjured dogs in the yard, speaks with the defendant, who refuses repeatedly to provide identification, flees into the home. This court accepted and assumed without specific discussion that that entry was valid. And it was, and it should be. And Richter does, in fact, say specifically. Now, Richter was a case where, admittedly, much of the discussion was about whether the officer, in fact, had to actually see the suspect flee into the home where he ultimately made entry, instead of relying on a witness who had seen that suspect just minutes before the officer arrived do that. And the court said that was fine, but also said hot pursuit gets you into the trailer. An alternative basis was the exigency presented by the fact that the suspect entered a trailer where there were people apparently sleeping or feigning sleep on the floor.
All right. And in your brief, you spend a significant amount of time talking about Justice Prosser's concurrence in Sanders and then the majority writing in Richter that seems to focus. And now, your opposing counsel disputes from the brief submitted, opposing counsel disputes the idea that the court has adopted Justice Prosser's reasoning. I'd like to get your position on that.
I think the court was clear that it did adopt Justice Prosser's concurrence from Sanders.
And would you please articulate the holding that you are asking us to apply?
That hot or immediate pursuit of a suspect based on probable cause that the suspect has committed a jailable offense justifies warrantless entry into the home to detain and or arrest.
Are you asking us to state explicitly that that is a bright line rule, or are you asking us to consider that within the context of other factors?
I think it's a bright line rule. I think Richter already says that. It's become a little bit murky because of the additional discussion of other exigencies, but I think Richter already says that, and I'm asking the court to clarify that, yes, that is a bright-line rule.
Didn't Justice Prosser couch it in the terms, didn't he couch it in the terms of saying, gee, there's nothing in the law that would prohibit a court from determining that hot pursuit for a jailable offense by and of itself. So isn't there a little room for this court to provide clarification?
Absolutely. And I'm asking for that clarification today. And I'm asking
right,
for
but the way you just said it a minute ago, you made it sound like you were taking a position it was already a hard and fast rule. So I just wanted to get an idea of where you were coming from.
No, I think we absolutely do need further clarification.
And you're asking for a per se rule that hot pursuit is an exception to the requirement of a warrant. Is that correct?
Hot pursuit or a jailable offense
is a per se rule when allowing for no warrant.
With probable cause for a jailable offense is a per se rule, yes.
So if someone were speeding and the officer, in and of itself speeding is not a jailable offense, but what
true.
If other people are around and the officer says, I think that was endangering safety by use of a dangerous weapon, the weapon being the car. So then the officer can pursue the person and go into the house?
Well, the officer is going to attempt to traffic
stop,
right?
So many things are jailable. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So many things are jailable. There has to be a limit.
That's true. But the officer in that case, don't forget, is going to attempt a traffic stop. And when if the defendant stops, then, later on, whatever charges flow from that, there may be none, there may be several. We
and
don't
here,
know.
They didn't charge him with fleeing.
No, they didn't. They did not charge him with fleeing. This was a slow motion kind
of pursuit.
I'm
sorry, red lights on.
What did they charge him with?
Charged with the 10th offense, drunk driving.
Okay.
And I believe obstructing.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kara Mealy, and I represent the defendant, Richard Weber, in this matter. The warrant requirement is the rule, not the exception, and that rule has particular force when applied to the home. There is one exception to the warrant requirement when we're talking about the home, and that exception is for exigent circumstances. This is a true emergency situation, and I want to pause for a second and talk about what that situation looks like. And it's pretty simple. There would be immediate and serious consequences to delaying police action. To put it colloquially, something bad would happen if the officer doesn't get into the house right away.
Okay, let me ask you something. If we were to conclude as a court that fleeing an officer on a public highway, so long as you make it home, you're going to be okay, aren't we then promoting that activity?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question, but I think the key is it's not a situation where it's if you make it to home base, you're safe. The legislature has acted in this regard, and when people flee from officers, they can be charged with a crime. They can go to jail. So
that's right. That's counsel's point. That was the crime that was committed on a public highway.
Correct.
And he happened to get home, but that's why the officer was in hot pursuit, because of a jailable offense on a public highway. And then, the fact that he got home shouldn't stop the officer from concluding the arrest.
Sure. And, Your Honor, once the suspect crosses the threshold of the home, a rule applies, and it is the warrant requirement. And in the absence of an emergency, in the absence of a situation where there would be immediate and serious consequences to the investigation, in the absence of a situation where the cops would lose some sort of evidence to prosecute Mr. Weber for that crime, you can't go in the house. And that's the point here, what we're talking about. There was nothing threatening the state's ability to prosecute Mr. Weber for these crimes. I'm not conceding probable cause for the misdemeanors. But the point was, he was sitting in his house. And there was nothing getting in the way of the state for prosecuting from these offenses. There is a two-part test for determining exigent circumstances. And it asks, is there a compelling need to act, and is there no time to get a warrant? The United States Supreme Court has made it clear in McNeely that this test must consider the totality of the circumstances when we're determining whether there is an emergency.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. What is your position on the relationship between hot pursuit and exigent circumstances? Is hot pursuit a species of exigent circumstances, or are they two different things?
Your Honor, they're two different things. My position is that hot pursuit is a fact to be considered among all other facts in the case to determine whether there is an exigency, a compelling need to act, and no time to get a warrant.
So hot pursuit is an element in your analysis of whether there is an exigent circumstance warranting that warrantless seizure.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think if we look at the definitions of the two, it makes a lot of sense. Hot pursuit has been defined in the cases as the immediate and continuous pursuit of a suspect from the scene of a crime. It's a chase. When we look at the definition of exigent circumstances, it requires a compelling need to act and no time to get a warrant. So to say that the chase of a suspect into their home when nothing else is going on and the suspect's just sitting in the home, to say that that will always create a situation where there is a compelling need to act and perhaps more importantly, no time to get a warrant, would amount to an overgeneralization. And that is exactly why per se exigencies are impermissible in the law.
Counselor, you rely on your rule that per se exigencies are not permissible on McNeely. And McNeely is a search case. So what they needed to get was a search warrant. Here, I see this case more in line with Santana, which is a seizure case. So what they needed was an arrest warrant. Isn't that the kind of warrant you're saying they didn't have? They should have let them go in the house and get an arrest warrant so they could go into the house and get them. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. The reason that it interests me, it's an interest I've had for a long time, but I don't know if we can always transport language from a search case into a seizure case because the court will reason through it differently in that a search case protects your privacy interest where a seizure case protects your liberty interest, both Fourth Amendment, but the court talks about them a little bit differently. Do you see that mattering at all to this case?
I understand what you're referring to. I've read the concurrence in Dump Street, and I think it's an interesting issue. I think Peyton is quite clear, though, that regardless if we're talking about search or seizure, when we're talking about the home, you need a warrant or exigent circumstances to get into the house, regardless. And
I'm sorry. Peyton said either kind of warrant will do it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Didn't Peyton say either kind of warrant will enable entry into the house?
You need a warrant or you need exigent circumstances.
Yes, either one.
Correct.
Peyton said you got either one, search or seizure, you can
That's
go
correct.
Into the house.
Correct,
okay.
Let's talk for a moment about that. If, you know, on the trial court bench, I would sign warrants for people's arrest on a regular basis. I didn't. Are you saying so long as that warrant is there, an officer can go into someone's home?
Well, there has to be probable cause to support the warrant.
Right, but then the officer doesn't have to knock on the door or, you know, try to wait for them.
I think you do have to go
straight in the house. That's in and of itself, that's what they should do.
Your Honor,
what I hear you saying is they should have waited, gone and gotten the warrant, and then seized him.
Well, Your Honor, I think the officer could have simply knocked on Mr. Weber's door to begin with.
If he doesn't answer.
If he doesn't answer, another alternative would have been you could have mailed a citation for the traffic offense to Mr. Weber's house, and if the state thought that there was probable cause for jailable offenses in this case, they could have mailed a summons and complaint if they didn't want to wait for a warrant.
I understand what you're saying. Having said that, what I hear you saying is that a warrant for the seizure of the person is sufficient then. That should have been their remedy. You go get the warrant for the seizure of the person, and then they can go in the house. Is that really what you're saying? Be careful with that.
I'm not sure I'm following, Your Honor. I am saying you need a warrant to enter into a person's home to make an arrest or to search, unless there is an emergency.
Okay. And what you're saying the officer should have done here is, for the fleeing offense, let him go into his home, go get a warrant from a judge, and then go into his home and arrest him.
Correct.
Okay.
Did Deputy Dornhorst testify what he would have done if he had not entered Weber's garage?
Yes, Your Honor.
This seems to follow up, Justice.
Sure. I believe the testimony was he would have tried other means. He didn't elaborate on what those means would be, but I'm guessing it would be.
Didn't he say he would still have questioned Weber because he would have knocked on the front door or pursued other means?
That's correct. That's correct.
It seems to me there's something that is very bothersome. and I think it comes through in your brief, that this brake light is not a jailable offense, and the state recognizes, okay, you're out. Can't do, it's not an exigent circumstance if it's not jailable. And if I remember Prosser's concurrence, he said, hey, how do you know whether it's jailable or not? Don't you know all the facts? So that he didn't like this jailable versus non-jailable, if
right.
I read that, if I remember that correctly. Okay, so you have a situation, it's a non-jailable offense, and within a relatively few feet, which must mean a relatively short amount of time, the lights go on, and you don't have to stop on a dime if the officer has his lights or siren on. You have to do it safely and get out of everybody's way, etc., as I understand the law. So within a very short time, Weber enters the driveway. Are we in curtilage?
Well, I think that kind of goes back to the Chief Justice point about, I think there is some room in the law for questioning whether the driveway is curtilage. I don't think that's been well established. For sure, an attached garage is. But this is where we start questioning whether you have different protection if it's a seizure or a search, because a driveway is open to visitors generally. A garage, on the other hand, is certainly not.
Okay. So you don't have a jailable offense here, but that the state can make it a jailable offense and enter the house by saying you're fleeing or obstructing justice. And so it's sort of the state is bringing itself up by its own bootstraps to get an entry into the sacred home, the curtilage or the garage here. And it just doesn't seem right that the state can turn a non-jailable offense into a jailable offense. Now, it might, if it will, as the state says, a 5-mile chase, drop it down to 2 or even 1 mile under the right circumstances. But within feet here, I don't see how bodes well for the state, and that bothers me. And how do you? What's the remedy for that?
Sounds like your concern is potentially that this may encourage officers to kind of create the hot pursuit themselves.
Well, they do it automatically if they put on the lights. Here, where the guy put on the lights, that is now. If you don't stop, you're fleeing or obstructing.
Yeah, and I think it depends on the facts of the case. I mean, ultimately, it boils down to the officer has to be able to point to some facts that demonstrate that there was actually fleeing. And if that is the case, I'm not saying that, you know, it's game over. If there's probable cause for fleeing for a jailable offense, you continue to run the analysis. But I want to be clear, probable cause, even for a serious crime, gets you a warrant. It doesn't get you into the house in the absence of an emergency.
Well,
that's
how do you reconcile that with footnote 5 of your brief, where you expressly acknowledge that Ferguson adopted Justice Prosser's concurrence in Sanders? Now, you try to limit it in footnote 5. You say, to the extent that Justice Prosser argued there should be no bright line rule precluding a finding of exigency in a case involving a misdemeanor. So in other words, you're focused there on the misdemeanor felony distinction. But you go on in this fairly lengthy footnote to acknowledge that in Ferguson, any jailable offense for which hot pursuit is occurring could serve as exigent circumstances, provided that the totality of the circumstances would land a court to make the determination that the same was appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the let's assume that what the court found is exactly what happened, that the officer put the lights on, and there's nothing in the record to indicate that Mr. Weber did not have the opportunity to stop, but continued to go into the garage. And so again, the court found probable cause to determine that Mr. Weber intentionally disobeyed the officer's attempt to stop him. So how does that fit in with you? How would you have us plug that into the totality of the circumstances? Your opposing counsel says, well, once she says there is already a per se rule, but then she says if there's not, you should create one because it's in keeping with Sanders and Ferguson and Richter. But you say in your footnote that it's a totality of the circumstances that could get you there. So you're not discounting or you're not disagreeing with the idea that the hot pursuit for probable cause for a jailable offense could lead the officers into the home. So how would you have us apply that?
Your Honor, correct. A hot pursuit could create an exigency. But what I'm saying is the ultimate test is whether there's a compelling need to act and no time to get a warrant. That you don't look at the totality of the circumstances to determine whether there was an
immediate... Then how in that situation would it ever be a factor unless you started your argument by saying, you summed it up in a very colloquial manner, something bad would happen if the police didn't go in right away, by which I inferred you meant physical violence, or I left room for destruction of evidence.
Something related to the investigation, yes.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, if that would be what brings us across the line for you, why is the hot pursuit necessary? Would those plus factors by themselves justify?
And that's a good question.
Well, stated otherwise, when would it ever be relevant?
It's a good question. I think that the chase certainly might create a greater likelihood of reasonableness depending on all of the facts of a particular case. For example, let's say you have an officer that says, I was confronted with facts A, B, and C, and based on these facts, I determined that there would be immediate and serious consequences if I didn't get into that house immediately. Perhaps a court might look at that and say, listen, there's a chase going on, things are moving quickly, you interpreted these facts this way, and we're going to say that's reasonable. Whereas perhaps those same facts in a different scenario, not involving a chase, the court may come out a different way. I'm saying it's a factor.
What about, we've been talking a lot about the brake light here, that malfunctioned. There was also testimony about weaving over the fog line. I can't remember exactly what hour this took place at. My memory is this is one of the classic times that this is during the nighttime hours.
Your Honor, that is not in the record. The time of day for this stop is not in the record.
It's not in the record?
It's not in the record.
All right. So we have a weaving automobile with a burned out or malfunctioning brake light. And then a vehicle, a motorist, who does not obey the officer's signal to stop. Could a reasonable officer under those circumstances form a reasonable, articulable suspicion that drunk driving was occurring?
Your Honor, weaving over the fog line, it's in itself, is not reasonable suspicion to stop for OWI. That's State Beat Post. That much we know. If you combine that with the fact that he didn't respond to the, you know, he didn't stop right away, maybe you could get to reasonable suspicion, but you need probable cause.
He didn't stop until he got into the garage.
Right. Yeah. And I think if you added that with the fact that he weaved, maybe you could get to reasonable suspicion for OWI, but you need probable cause. And none of the hallmarks for OWI are present until after the deputy goes inside the garage.
And you're talking about when the officer detained him because the officer happened to get to the doorway of the garage. The doorway leading from the garage into the house.
Correct.
Before Mr. Weber got into the house.
Correct.
Doesn't hot pursuit almost by definition present the plus factors that you would ask us to apply? And what I mean by that is if an officer is pursuing a suspect, the suspect has already evidenced a desire not to comply with the law and not to be taken. If that person then goes into an enclosed building, wouldn't a reasonable officer be concerned that there might be a weapon secreted in that building? there might be innocents who would be in harm's way if he was allowed to pursue his course. Doesn't that in and of itself suggest to the officer that he must go in to restrain the person?
And I think, as the state acknowledges in its reply brief, in a lot of cases when there is a chase, there are going to be other factors present, like you just pointed out. But the point is, the officers can't speculate, he's running from me because he's going to destroy some evidence or he's got a weapon at home. We require the officer to point to objective facts to support that. And because the point is, the officer is supposed to be acting with a warrant. And when he doesn't, he or she doesn't, they need to make well-considered decisions to do so. And that requires pointing to specific facts. We don't even allow reasonable suspicion Terry stops based on a hunch. We certainly can't allow warrantless home entries based on the idea that maybe he's running because he's hiding something.
Is it not a factor that the defendant was in the process of committing a jailable offense in the officer's presence?
I don't think that that's a one way or the other tips the scales. I'm not sure I'm following, Your Honor.
In English common law, one of the justifications for a hot pursuit exception to the warrant requirement was that the defendant was committing a felony in his presence. And in his presence was a key factor because that gave rise to the need to immediately cease the felonious activity. Does that not play a factor in hot pursuit in our jurisprudence? Isn't if a defendant is committing a jailable offense in the officer's presence, does that not require that he take reasonable steps necessary to cease that unlawful behavior?
Well, I think that the officer can take reasonable steps to make a seizure in public, and the officer can do that without a warrant. But when that situation transfers into the home, the warrant requirement is the rule, regardless of whether the crime was committed in front of the officer or not.
But that was under English common law, that was the justification for going in the home. The offense had been committed in the officer's presence, and that gave the officer the justification to go into the home without a warrant. Why should that be different here?
Well, and I also point out, I do believe in common law, but the hot pursuit rule was limited to felons.
Yes.
As well. I guess my answer is things have changed since common law. We have a test that the United States Supreme Court has articulated. It requires an emergency to get into the home without a warrant.
Since we
deal with the totality of the circumstances, I want to make sure I understand all the circumstances. The lights were put on. Was the siren at all activated?
There's no testimony on that point, Your Honor.
I think the testimony was that from the time that he turned on his lights until the time he pulled into the driveway, it was 100 feet. Is that the testimony?
The deputy, yes. The
deputy testified, which would be, at my guess, is a little more than twice the width of this hearing room. What about the driveway itself? Is that included or not included in the 100 feet?
Your Honor, that is not. My understanding was he said that he flipped the lights on when Mr. Weber was 100 feet from his driveway, and there's nothing in the record to indicate how long the driveway was.
That was my next question.
Yeah.
So the only number we have is the 100 feet.
Yeah. I did put a footnote, and I did the math, just assuming for the sake of argument that he was going 20 miles per hour, 15 miles per hour, as most people probably are when they're making a turn. It would be a matter of seconds.
It would be what?
A matter of seconds, Your Honor. I want to talk quickly about...
Before you shift gears, I want to change the facts on you a little bit because I think both sides are asking us to create a rule here. So if we had a little bit different facts, we still have the broken taillight, we have the weaving, but let's say the lights are activated and Mr. Weber accelerates and is speeding and pulls into his driveway and runs into the house. Does the officer, in your mind, still need to get a warrant before he pursues Mr. Weber into his garage?
I would say that is a good question, and I would say it depends. And I'm only going to say it depends because I think we should be factoring in the severity of the offense in terms of whether there should be an immediate entry, but the fact that there was running, I think the officer in that situation could reasonably say, based on those facts, Mr. Weber would continue to be a flight risk, even once he was in his home. But again, I think Welsh makes it clear that the severity of the offense should be considered in determining any exigency. So it would depend, I think, on what kind of crime we're talking about, if it was in addition to the fleeing or not.
Thank you.
I'm interested in what kind of test, and I'm interested in that from the states, too. What kind of opinion does the court write, setting forth a test that's going to guide police officers, prosecutors, defense counsel, and the courts? Now, if I understand it, your test is, and I'm reading from your brief, page 9, but I probably could get it elsewhere, that the test for the hot pursuit, which is part of the test for exigent circumstances, is a compelling need for official action. That goes to evidence, personal injury, fleeing, and no time to secure a warrant. And you get that test from a whole series of cases that say you look at the totality of the circumstances and that there's no per se rule. And the no per se rule is a requirement in the U.S. Supreme Court cases, whether they're seizure or search.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm getting the compelling need to act and no time to get a warrant. It originates from Michigan v. Tyler, but it was most recently stated and applied in Missouri v. McNeely. And I think McNeely is very relevant to this case because it gives us that overarching principle. It tells us when we're determining whether that test is satisfied, we have to look at all of the facts of the case. And the reason why, the court, in a footnote, I think it's footnote 3 in McNeely, it talks about why we're supposed to consider all these facts. And that is because most exceptions to the warrant requirement require an assessment of whether the policy justifications underlying the exception are met. And the best way to do that is to consider all of the facts. And when we start limiting the factors that a court can consider in assessing reasonableness, we run the risk of insulating constitutional violations from judicial review. And this case is a perfect example of that. When you understand the policy justifications underlying the exigency doctrine, which are there are immediate and serious consequences related to the investigation if the police don't act immediately, if you only consider the state's test, which is was there a chase and was there probable cause for a crime, we're not asking the question of whether there would be immediate and serious consequences to delaying police action. And that is the problem with the per se rule. And I think McNeely is very clear on that point. I understand it was a destruction of evidence case, but the underlying logic is clear. Per se exigencies are impermissible. And the state is asking for one today. And I just want to touch quickly on Ferguson and Justice Prosser's concurrence in Sanders. As I understand Ferguson, Justice Prosser's concurrence arose because the question was in Ferguson whether the jury should have been instructed on whether the warrantless entry in that case was permissible, was justified by exigent circumstances, and I think it was a misdemeanor in Ferguson, and it was a threat to the safety. I think it was a child was in the apartment, and there was a dangerous situation. And so the court brought up the Sanders concurrence to say, you know what, we agree with Justice Prosser's point that we should not be precluding an exigency analysis just because a misdemeanor is occurring. And I agree. I think that was 100% the right decision for this court to make, because there should not be bright-line rules in Fourth Amendment analysis. But Justice Prosser did make, as I read his concurrence, he made a second point in that concurrence, which was that he thought that hot pursuit, the immediate and continuous pursuit of a suspect from a scene of a crime, alone is always an emergency. And I did not read Ferguson as adopting that part of Justice Prosser's concurrence. It was not a hot pursuit case. There would be no need to do that. And I have deep respect for Justice Prosser, and I know he's not here, and I'm sure he would give me a run for my money, but I will point out that Justice Prosser's concurrence does not talk about the fact that we are supposed to be considering the totality of circumstances in analyzing exigency, and it was written before McNeely, before the court made clear per se exigencies are bad.
But McNeely was a seizure of evidence.
A search case. Correct.
And that's what Chief Justice Rogenczyk was talking about before. Shouldn't there be a distinction, seizure of the person versus evidence?
I don't think the law provides for that, Your Honor, at this point.
I just want to go back just a little bit one more time. What you think the officer should have done, let's get rid of the taillight. Let's just have it be a fleeing case,
okay.
Jailable offense. You're saying the officer should have let the individual go in his home, go get a warrant, and then come back later that evening and arrest.
Well, Your Honor, I think with the advancements in technology, it's not even necessary for the officer to leave the scene of the crime. And I will
Okay, assuming that's the case.
Okay.
So he goes to sleep in his home, and the officer secures the warrant, and you're saying the officer could enter the home that evening with that warrant to arrest him for fleeing.
I think
that's the practice that you would like this court to adopt.
I mean, are you saying, do they have to knock on the door first? Is that the question? Or are you just saying, can they act pursuant to the warrant in that situation?
Okay, I want to just clarify that what you kind of want this court to adopt McNeely in these contexts. If you know somebody's fleeing into their home, let them go, secure the perimeter or whatever, get a warrant, and come back and arrest the person for something like this offense.
Yes, that's correct.
Is a moving violation jailable?
Is a what violation?
Moving traffic violation jailable.
A moving traffic.
It depends on the violation.
Yeah.
Some are and some aren't.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fog light, a fog line. Most people don't even know what that fog line means.
I don't know one way or the other, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
I said I don't know the answer to that one way or the other.
That wasn't part of this. I don't think that the per se rule started with McNeely. I think it goes way back. And that the U.S. Supreme Court cases say you have to take each case on its facts and facts and circumstances. And that you just don't have a per se rule. And this court has been overturned on that. In case law, that there is no per se rule. You have to look at each of the facts.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is longstanding, it's, I would say, boilerplate Fourth Amendment law,
exactly.
That reasonableness determinations are to be based on the totality of circumstances.
That's right. And the Fourth Amendment says the rights of the people to be secure in their persons, that would be seizure of the person, arrest, house, which would be maybe seizure in the house, or it could be search of a house, right? Papers, which is a search, and effects. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly described the place to be searched, etc. So this, on its face, this amendment does not make a distinction between searches and seizures and homes and papers.
That's correct, Your Honor. I see that my red line is on.
It is. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
And we have rebuttal.
You know, would you again state what the test is that this court should adopt? Because in the defendant's brief, they say that your test is, and I'm reading from the bottom of five, specifically the state seeks a rule that it is categorically reasonable for law enforcement to conduct a warrantless home entry and arrest whenever there is hot pursuit of a suspect based on probable cause for a jailable offense. Now, I think that's what you said, too.
Yes, and
that,
reading
that
again.
That is your test.
Hot pursuit of a suspect based on probable cause for a jailable offense is a standalone justification for the warrantless home entry and arrest. There's been a lot of discussion.
So it's a per se rule. Once you get all those factors, that's it.
Look, totality of the circumstances isn't thrown out here. We
always
look to the totality of the circumstances to assess whether there is, in fact, hot pursuit, whether there is, in fact, a separate exigency to warrant entry. We always look to the facts of
the case.
Well,
and that's because the entry has to be based, it has to be reasonable.
Exactly.
And reasonableness is, we have said a million times, a totality of the circumstances.
Yes.
You know, what bothers me about this case is the rule we're being asked to put together, both by you and by opposing counsel. And I think you've briefed it very well and you've argued it very well. But, you know, when I look at these facts, it, to me, feels different to let the officer go into the garage, even though the curtilage is part of the home, and take the man's arm and say, come out here and talk to me. If the man ran all the way into his house, turned around and said, I won't stop, and he runs in and slams his door, I think it would feel different to me if the officer broke down the door to go get him. Okay? And to me, you always have to go back and look at the reasonableness of all the actions. So you get back to the totality of the circumstances, even with any kind of an exigency.
Absolutely, and that is always the case. And it is always a question of reasonableness. And there's been some suggestion that perhaps there's no compelling need to act in a circumstance like this when there's hot pursuit. I submit that there is. The compelling need is to allow an officer to complete a valid detention.
Well,
and to not encourage people to flee from an otherwise valid stop.
Under counsel's suggestion, though, the officer could secure the perimeter, get a warrant, and then come back and arrest. What's the problem with that?
It encourages people to run from the police and take refuge in their homes for a variety of reasons, and I don't think we, and in particular officers, ought to have to sit and debate the severity of the particular offense, what the defendant might be doing in the home. The fact that someone is fleeing an officer from a valid traffic stop could mean a number of things. It could mean the suspect intends to go in the house, take refuge, arm himself with a weapon. We don't know. The officer doesn't know, but the officer shouldn't have to. The officer should be permitted to complete a stop. And that's what happened here. Isn't it reasonable? He took hold of Mr. Weber. He didn't fall into the home and go rummage through his home. He pulled him outside to have the conversation he was entitled to have with him out on the highway. And that Mr. Weber changed into a circumstance that required the officer to come get him so that that valid stop could occur. That is inherently and entirely reasonable, which is what the Fourth Amendment ultimately commands.
Could I ask you to elucidate that just a little bit? So what I'm looking for is, aside from the other types of factors we consider as exigent circumstances, tell me what it is about hot pursuit that says this is why you don't need a warrant to go in and get him. What are those factors?
And you touched on it earlier. The officer is in immediate pursuit, and I think that's a better way to say it than hot, an immediate pursuit from the scene of a crime. Now, that doesn't happen terribly often, frankly, but when it does, the officer gets to make that stop.
Why? Why does he get to do that without a warrant?
Well, I guess I think the best way to say it is the corollary, because suspects can't be encouraged to run from the police and take refuge in a private place, be at their home or somewhere else. I mean, the home is special, but it's not ghoul.
Well, is there any reason, aside from the pedagogical aspect of it, that he ought to be able to complete that arrest without a warrant?
I think that's the best way to say it. Could I list other specific reasons? No, I think that's the predominant one. When an officer is in immediate pursuit for an offense, he's got probable cause, he's watched it happen, he gets to complete that stop.
Is it because of the need to bring to a close the unlawful behavior?
Well, it's because it's eminently reasonable, isn't it, for police officers with lawful authority to detain and or arrest suspects, right?
The
rule I'm asking for facilitates that process. That's otherwise it's defeated.
But that is reasonable for officers to detain people who would crime. But the question is it reasonable for them to do that by crossing into their home to get them? So what is it about the, as you call it, the immediate pursuit that independently gives the justification to do this without a warrant? What about the situation that it would be unreasonable to wait and get a warrant?
I see my red light is on.
Yes,
I don't want to
it is. You can answer this question, though.
Please.
It is the immediate pursuit. It is the officer witnessing the crime in a way, and it is the necessity of completing a valid detention and discouraging people from fleeing otherwise valid detentions. That cannot, should not be the law. It's not reasonable.
Thank you. Now, I have another question. If it's totality of circumstances and you visualize everything, how do you state that rule rather than stating the rule which you said was correct, that it is categorically reasonable to conduct a warrantless home entry and arrest whenever there's hot pursuit or immediate pursuit of a suspect based on probable cause for a jailable offense? I don't read that into your test of totality of circumstances. It's a categorical test.
I'm sorry, again, am I permitted to answer?
Yeah, you know, this is the last question from the bench because we want to be fair to both sides, and with all due respect, we haven't given extra time to the defendant's counsel. So this is, you can answer this question, but then we are concluding.
I have one.
Just a minute, Justice Bradley. She's going to answer Justice Abrahamson's question.
I think, Justice Abrahamson, the totality of the circumstances is used to determine whether, in fact, hot pursuit exists. Once it does, it is categorically and standalone a valid reason to go into the home. It does not require proof of an additional exigency.
And you don't think that determining whether hot pursuit exists depends on whether there's time to get a warrant and whether there's a danger? Dangerous.
No, those are separate exigencies, none of which are required to be paired with another.
Thank you very much. We are Justice Bradley, we are being unfair to defense counsel, not because the attorneys are not paying attention to the light, but because the court is. I would urge you to keep your question unless you absolutely must ask it.
I want to ask this question.
Well, I know you want to.
This is what's been bothering me about this case all along. The assertion that this is hot pursuit. We don't know the time of day. There was no siren. 100 feet. The elements of fleeing are that a defendant is knowingly fleeing. I think about, when I started this case, I thought about myself driving along.
What is the question, Justice Bradley?
I thought of myself driving along in the middle of the day, and all of a sudden I look in my rearview mirror that I've been checking periodically, and there's an ambulance with a light behind me, much closer than I would have expected. So here we have 100 feet. I can see a knowing element if it's a half mile, if it's a quarter mile, if there's a siren, if it's night and the light is clearly visible. But how do we even know there was indicia of knowingly fleeing, number one? And number two, does the length of the light being on make a difference? What if it was 50 feet?
So again, I think the hypotheticals could go on endlessly. If you want to disagree with me on the facts that they state probable cause, do so. Give me the rule of law.
Let me ask this as a matter of law then. Would 50 feet with a light on constitute probable cause for fleeing?
Alone, I can't answer that. There's too much else going on. And again, please don't let bad facts, if you want to disagree with me on those, prevent the court from instituting good law.
Thank you very much, counsel. And thank you both for a very, very good argument.